welcome to this week's edition of Two Men in the Middle, where two men in the middle of the country pontificate about politics, news, current events, and everything under the sun. I'm Brandon Koenig.
I'm Craig Huey.
So, Craig, it's been a little bit over a week since we've last podcasted. I think we've had a couple of weeks in between with just schedules and everything. And in that time, the slow-moving bureaucracy as it relates to the infrastructure bill has netted a win for Biden, a significant win with a 69-31 vote in the Senate. You had 19 Republicans.
19
join Democrats in supporting the bill, much higher than most pundits anticipated, and now moves to the House. So this can't be overstated because it's been decades since we've had an infrastructure bill of any kind, especially of this magnitude and reach, because we're also not just talking about kind of core infrastructure as far as, metal and steel and bridges, where we're also talking about fiber. We're talking about many other components as well that feed into what we consider infrastructure in the modern age, technologically. So what are your thoughts on how this passed the Senate and what this means going forward?
So I'm a little surprised that this passed at all. I'm a little surprised that it passed with 19 Republican senators. Is this the way we're going to advance big legislation moving forward? Is that there's a bipartisan piece that everybody votes on, and then there's a reconciliation piece that a party pushes through? When they came up with that plan, I mean, a couple months ago when they announced that, remember Biden had that, he kind of had that gaffe where he came out very strongly and said the two are related together and I won't move on one without the other. Then he had to completely backtrack on that. So this thing got off to a really rocky start. And to be honest, I just didn't think the Republicans would give Biden another win. I thought they saw the COVID bill as kind of as much legislation as they thought Biden should be passing at this point. And I'm kind of surprised that 19 of them actually voted for it. And I think that just shows how popular these bills are, how long the American public's been waiting for one of these bills. Rick Scott went on Fox News Sunday and complained bitterly about this bill and complained bitterly about the deficits spending it would put the country in and add to our debt, then admitted they are going to spend every cent of the $38 billion Florida gets to update their infrastructure, which is rated currently at a C- right now. So I think the tell on this, a lot like the package for COVID, while you're going to hear some traditional Republicans speak on debts and deficit and leaving this to our children and the impact that that's going to have, I think at most that surface level, I don't think the Republicans really they really don't believe or now is not the time for fiscal conservativeness. I think they saw an opportunity to pass a popular bill. They didn't want another popular bill to pass without Republican support. They jumped on this bill. And I think for the 19 Republicans that signed off on it, they get to go back to their state with a win, because a lot of this bill is going to be shovel-ready projects for roads, right, bridges, seaports, infrastructure that we desperately need. And when those projects go up, they're all going to have that sign by them that said, you know, this shovel-ready project is compliments of the 2021 infrastructure bill or whatever that's going to be. I think the Republicans, they saw an easy win. It's something that they could easily be bipartisan on. And when Mitch McConnell was one of those 19,
I think just going to say that
where he's at with it.
Mitch McConnell's support when he spoke out in support of this, I think that was a turning point for many other Republicans, because it gave them the confidence to come out for it as well. It also blunted the impact of Trump's opposition and his vocal admonitions to Republicans to not support it. So that made a huge difference. And then, as McConnell has said, I think many of these Republicans are trying to find anything that they can take home as a win and say that they've accomplished something. We're in a Washington now where you know, just bloviating is kind of the name of the game. There's so little that's accomplished. And this is something that does have bipartisan merit. And being as large as it is and the impact it has, like there are projects that impact every state in this bill. So, you know, those conservative Republican senators can go home and say that this directly impacts my constituencies here, and this is how. So that also makes it easier to vote for. You know, so it's a unique piece of legislation.
How can any Republican with a straight face get on TV somewhere and start up the old fashioned debt and deficit talk? I mean,
it's disingenuous.
Who is the audience for that anymore? Who is polling that says, man, I'm really worried about the debt?
Well, and that's the thing, right? Because the I think the people that do are a minority now. Like, they're definitely not the Trump base, because, you know, that is something that hasn't been top of mind for the last, you know, four years. And, you know, and as we said off air, you know, Republicans have long just added to the debt and deficit at clips higher than many Democratic presidents. Trump blew Obama out of the water as far as his deficit spending.
And Bush started it all.
And yet, you know, it was during the Trump era that Republicans entirely even just stopped talking about. They stopped giving lip service to it, and it was no longer even a talking point. So to bring it back up now is just, you know, I think complete political posturing, and it's transparent, right? I mean, it doesn't pass the smell test, I think, with most Americans.
And I think for most Americans, can you think of one bad thing that's happened in your lifetime because of our debt? I can't think of one.
Right.
I mean, well, there's some abstract concepts of how inflation, I was like, but most, and I'm like most Americans, we don't, that's way too complicated of a topic to try to seriously understand.
And it's way too complicated. And, you know, it's bills like this do add or negatively impact the debt going forward. But we're in such a hole already that even like a solution is just completely outside the scope of what most Americans can comprehend, because there's no way we can start reducing the debt quickly enough to even get, you know, back to where we were in the 90s when we had Bill Clinton and we had a balanced budget amendment. Like, that's just so far removed from where we are now. And the cuts would have to be draconian. And the problem lies that, you know, there are, to really make the cuts that have to be made, there are core pillars that have to be touched.
Yeah.
I mean, and you have Democrats and Republicans that are refusing to touch those. So as long, you know, the third rail of politics has always been Social Security, but for Republicans, it might as well be the military and defense spending. And they don't want to touch that.
That's my point. I don't see any Republican that's going to pick up the entitlements or military cut mantle. And I think we've beaten this debt topic enough to understand the government spends money in three main places: entitlements and the government.
Yeah,
that's only. I'm sorry. Sure. I just pulled a Rick Perry there. And thought I forgot the third one completely through the thing. So, I mean, the government spends money on the military, entitlements, Social Security. Those are the big bulls in the tent. And this was always Paul Ryan's thing. If you're not going to tackle those three, what are we really tackling? And to your point, I think it was Stalin that said, like, one person's death is a tragedy, a million is a statistic. What's $30 trillion? We're in debt roughly $30 trillion, I believe, is the current number right now.
Right.
That's an incomprehensible number for normal, everyday people to understand. How would you even go about paying back $30 trillion? And is there a payback? Is that how this debt works? I mean, people who try to, Republican politicians who try to bring this home to their constituents, try to put this in kind of a kitchen table kind of setting, you know, in something we can all understand. You have credit card debts, you rack it up when you need it, you pay it off over time. Is that the way this $30 trillion thing works? My point being, it's gotten so big and so complex that to your point, I think everybody is just completely ignoring it at this point.
I think they are too. And I think once upon a time, you know, those comparisons to like a household budget or, you know, personal debt had merit, but they really don't anymore. And I mean, one of the major differences is the government can spend to oblivion. Like they can run up debts and deficits. There aren't the same type of real time implications and consequences that an average person or family would face, right? I mean, it's very different circumstances. So granted, you're talking about monetary policy, but you're talking one's at the micro level, one's at the macro level, and one's with, you know, an entity that has unlimited borrowing power and unlimited spending power. And again, if you're talking about in a household, that doesn't exist on either side.
Jonah Goldberg said today, I was listening to a podcast he was on, and he looked at our debt in different ways. And he was trying to think through, you know, what real jeopardy does carrying this much debt put us in? And he asked the question, what would have happened if after the sixth, if that crowd would have gotten a hold of Mike Pence, if that would have gone worse, if that would have played out in a different way, how many countries are going to be just hip to buy our bonds at that point? Or let's say we get into it with China over, I don't know, they roll into Hong Kong or Taiwan and we decide we're going to roll the U.S. military. How does China carries about $1 trillion of our debt. How does that work? I think what he was trying to get to is carrying this much debt may not be paying it back. It may be how it weakens our position as we try to act on the international stage. And I thought that was a really interesting perspective to try to think through that, okay, if Japan owns $1 trillion of our debt, China owns $1 trillion, how are we limited in what we can do if we are that much in debt to the international community?
Yeah, no, I think that's a better way to think about it, because I think it does impact the choices that other state actors make when they look at us and decide whether or not we are a reliable partner, whether or not we can, you know, fund a partnership, assist in a military endeavor. And then you look at other adversaries, you know, they look at it from the standpoint of that it gives them leverage, and that they, if they know that, you know, our debt is going to be an obstacle or a barrier to our involvement somewhere in the world, they're more likely to act and not have any restraint, because they know that we are going to be restrained because of the economic impact.
And one of the reasons we get away with racking up this kind of debt and people will still give us money and buy our debt is our stability. The fact that people know the United States is going to, in some ways, operate under a set of rules that are going to be enforced uniformly, and you can pretty much count on the performance of the American economy. Let another January 6th happen, or let that theme continue, and see what that does to us from a monetary possibility. If we lose that status of, you know, hey, of consistency, of that, hey, we are the economic standard. I believe the U.S. dollar like backs most monetary policy in the world. And that's because, again, our economic power and our stability. As we chip away at some of that, that may have effects on our debt that are unseen and that we're not kind of putting in play at this point in time.
Right.
Is the Tea Party completely gone? I mean, is this the salting of the earth of the Tea Party with the passages of this infrastructure bill and the COVID bills?
I think so. I mean, I think that the Tea Party has been, you know, flickering out for years now, whatever was left of it, the remnants of it. But I think that, you know, in terms of having any power, is there even still a Tea Party caucus in Congress? I know there was for a while.
Who would it be? I don't.
Yeah. I mean, I don't see. Or what would be the point? There's just no relevance left. Yeah. Clearly, anybody who would have been a part of it has abandoned the
that would be like, Brandon, you and I start a new podcast talking about 8-tracks. There's just no market for fiscal responsibility.
Right. I mean, it's completely gone. I mean, at this point. So it's, Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a good example of something that I think, was specific to the era and had, power and influence. And obviously it was because of the Tea Party that Republicans captured control of the House in 2010. There's a lot that goes back to that, right? Because it was during that ascent into power that enabled Republicans to redraw district boundaries and cement their House majority for a decade until 2018. And even now, they still have the levers of power from their state house wins back during that era that gives them the ability to draw maps and ensure that their power is still sustained. So the Tea Party was incredibly successful from that standpoint. As far as having any impact on monetary policy and reducing debt and deficit spending, though, I mean, no. I mean, it just hasn't.
So if I've got the timeline right, the $1.2 trillion, we'll call it hard infrastructure bill, that passed the Senate Wednesday-ish. And then there's the $3.2 trillion that we'll call soft infrastructure. This is child care credits, taking care of your elder care tax credits. This has a variety of things in it around green energy. This is the more social spending that the Republicans wanted no part of. My understanding, too, is they've also passed that through reconciliation through the Senate. And this is all going now to the House. Is that? Yes. And I don't think the House is scheduled to vote on this until like September 12th or something.
Yeah, it's like a month still. And then, of course, there's rumblings on timeline because there's House progressives that obviously want to move forward with their human infrastructure bill that includes much more spending. But that's the timeline as it exists today.
So what are the odds of both of these passing the House, you think?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. 50-50. It's hard because the Democrats' House majority, I think, is down to 3 seats. So it's a very, very tight majority. So they can't afford to lose anybody. And the Republicans in the House, for the most part, vote as a single block. So there just aren't any crossover votes anymore.
Do you think they'll get no crossover after 19 senators? You don't think they'll get a handful?
They might. I should say that they could. And they could get anywhere from 2 to 5, I would say. I would not expect more than a handful, like 5, though.
So I don't think there's any way the Dems in the House will sink the 1.2 shovel-ready projects infrastructure bill.
No, there's just too much at stake. Yeah, and this is like a one-shot deal.
And this just sticks it right up Trump's ass, too, that it was infrastructure week for 4 years and that they actually got this done. It gives somebody to run off. This gives everybody everything they want. If you voted for the bill and you like it, you've got projects to talk about that need to be done and things that make an impact on people's lives. These are things that directly are tied to jobs that people can see. And if you didn't vote for it, you've got a whole variety of fiscal responsibility issues that you could rail on if you want. So I just don't see how this is set up to where at least the $1.2 trillion shovel-ready infrastructure bill that the Senate passed through with 19 Republicans, I think that gets through the House fairly easily.
It's,
okay, what are we going to do about the larger soft infrastructure bill? And if that passes, great. If we decide to push that off or do something else with it, I don't think that's necessarily a loss either.
I don't think so either. I just don't see the future of that soft infrastructure bill after it would pass the House, right? I mean, it's just I don't see that going anywhere in the Senate.
Well, I think the Senate already passed it through reconciliation.
Oh, that's true. That's right. So it was already passed. Okay.
So they already passed it. This is the second time they would have passed something huge, like in the trillions in spending with not a single Republican vote. Is that bad?
I mean, I don't know if it's bad. I think it's kind of the new normal, right? I mean, for any bills, Democrats now, their strategy is find some type of economic component to be able to pass it through reconciliation. If they can find that it has that type of payment mechanism, it gives them an avenue. And I think that's just going to be the new norm. And really for both parties, unless something changes with the tactics, filibuster tactics.
And just to remind everybody, Trump passed his tax cuts through reconciliation.
Yeah, he did.
They didn't go out and build any type of bipartisan consensus for that.
Right. This started years ago, so this isn't new. But yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because briefly I somehow completely forgot that that had already been passed by reconciliation. I mean,
the three biggest pieces of legislation that impact probably the widest swath of Americans right now, if it's this infrastructure bill, if this $3.2 trillion thing passes, the COVID relief bill, and the tax cut, all of those were done in a completely partisan manner.
Yeah.
I guess if you like the policy or if you agree with the policy or if the policy does its intended, if it does what it was intended to do, does that matter anymore? And do you think it matters to Biden?
I mean, Biden is pretty old school in his approach. So I think it matters to him. I know he is very, I believe that he honestly and very genuinely wants to have bipartisan support as much as possible. But I mean, I think eventually he's going to see the reality, and he's running into up against that now, that that's going to be nearly impossible on most of the Democratic Party's priorities. I mean, it's just infrastructure is very unique, right? Because that's one of the few things both parties can get behind. Almost every other issue is not like that. There are very few bridges to find on many of these other issues.
As a Republican that voted for Biden, is Biden meeting your expectations? Has he not met those? Is this what you thought the Biden presidency would be? I guess, are you satisfied with that vote, or are there things that I don't think it would be? Yeah, I don't think there's anything that would make you say, "Oh, hell with it, I should have voted for Trump." I don't think that's on this side. But just, are you, as a Republican, are you getting what you expected out of crossing over to voting for Biden?
Yeah, no, I am. You know, and I'm glad you mentioned that. I mean, my expectations were very low because I was at the point I would take anybody over Trump practically. But I do think that, I mean, Biden, out of, I think, all the Democrats, was uniquely positioned to be effective and bring people together. And I would grade him probably like a B at this point, like between a B and a B minus. I think he's done fairly well. I think there's some things that have been lacking. I feel there's some more leadership he could have shown. Particularly like on the messaging side of COVID and vaccinations and what we're going through now with the haphazard messaging of the CDC. I would have liked to see his administration take a more proactive approach to distilling the facts for the American people and simplifying it so that it wouldn't be as confusing. I think that, I think on the foreign policy front, I'd like to see him get more engaged with what's happening with our allies. I mean, he's been overseas now. He held a press conference that was decent. I think he can get much more plugged in as far as what's happening, though, overseas. But I think on what's obtainable and achievable, I think he's done well. I think the infrastructure bill is a great example of that. He never gave up. He kept pushing and pushing, and that has paid off.
I like what you just said, that you are putting, as a Republican who really didn't see a viable Republican candidate to vote for, you have adjusted your expectations of what you're going to get out of a Democratic president. And I think that's where Republicans are still, oh my God, I can't believe they're spending all this. You can't. Do you know any Democrats? Do you know what we do when we get power? Yeah, you don't know the reason why this permanent majority has never really taken shape, because every time we grab the reins of power, we overreach and get booted right out of it very quickly. I mean, there is a potential. that is going to happen in 2022. I don't think there's any way the Democrats keep the House, just based on just how the levers of power come and go in the United States and, yeah. and just how our elections work. I think they know that. They're trying to get everything through before the end of the year because election season starts January 2022.
Right. And if we're in a scenario where Democrats lose the House and have the Senate, we're going to be back to gridlock.
Yeah. And I think that's exactly where we're heading. And I think they know that. So there's a rush to get as much of this stuff through as they can. Let's switch to in this infrastructure bill tucked into it. There was an attempt in this bill to raise. Let me backtrack. Taxes are going to go up in this bill, mostly on people who are the most wealthy. I think there are also some tolls and things like that go in. But another one of the big pillars of tax revenue is going to come from cryptocurrency. Now, this bill is 2,700 pages long. What's in it? Nobody really knows.
Right.
And I think I looked all over on the web to try to get a definition of what this cryptocurrency thing is. And I think I have it about 60% right. But basically, there's a lot of crypto transactions of people creating cryptocurrencies, buying and selling cryptocurrencies that are never reported to the IRS and people don't pay taxes on. Now, if you are a crypto broker, and there's some discussion about what that means, does that include the people that mine Bitcoin, the folks that owns the rig, that do all the blockchain transactions, that actually create the security behind it? And in return for that, they get Bitcoins. They may now have to start reaching out and logging and reporting on people who buy those Bitcoins from them. The CBO basically said this bill over 10 years with the cryptocurrency tax should generate around $28 billion in tax revenue. Just to give some folks some context of what that could do, I think they said it was $30 billion to replace every single bridge in the United States that had a rating of deficient. So they are counting on this tax revenue and growing this tax revenue off cryptocurrency as a major part of funding. Yeah. This is one of those things that more and more legislation is packed into these massive bills, and there's these small things you have to unpack. This is, I think, the government's first real regulatory and tax attempt at cryptocurrency, and I don't think it's going to be the last.
No, I think, and again, there's a lot here for government to understand and to grapple with, and processes that have to be in place. And cryptocurrency is at its advent. It's almost like we're, you know, the internet was, you know, a couple decades ago, and the government was trying to update, you know, policies around internet and communication policies. This is the first attempt. There will likely be many more. You know, this is not going to probably be, there's going to be a lot of changes to this over time, I would assume, just based on how this works out operationally.
And I think the White House has come out and said, yeah, we have no idea how we would enforce any of this. And what shape this actually takes, they don't really know yet. I'm just always amazed when people say, well, this blockchain technology, it's all, you know, deregulated and it's all democratized and there's no way the government of course there's a way the government
can. There's always a way. Yes. There's the government can find a way in.
And when they want to, they'll just do it. If anybody out there thinks that cryptocurrency is going to go unregulated much longer, you're just fooling yourself. And I think if you think that's a bad thing, for people like my wife and I, everyday investors who are long-termers, who go into the market, you put money in every month and you save it for retirement. That's what most people do. We would never even sniff a cryptocurrency. No. Because if Elon Musk can put out a tweet and drop the price by 20, that's never going to gain any wide scale acceptance. So I think the cryptocurrency is something interesting and something to watch out for.
I agree. Yeah, it's definitely something to watch, especially as it becomes just more widely adopted. I think it's one of these things that right now is still considered something of a trend. And so a lot of Americans look at it with kind of fascination and just kind of bewilderment. But, you know, as it And then too, I mean, there's so many cryptocurrencies right now, and because it's new, we really haven't seen the dust settle upon a handful that are going to be the ones that are sustained and have staying power. So, you know, that's, we're kind of, it's wild, wild west right now, as far as that's concerned.
And I think this is what crypto needs, some regulation in order to make it more acceptable to your everyday investor. I mean, now your folks that are hanging out on Reddit and all of this, that's just not something that your investors of folks that put money into the market every month to save for retirement, it's just too volatile. And I think if they actually added some regulation to it, you would attract more and a different kind of money to cryptocurrency that could actually help it be a little bit more stable. But I'm sure people will freak out. And I always love when some senator gets up and tries to explain, says, it's like, oh, for God's sake, just sit down. And Cruz, sit down too.
Right. Oh, yeah.
You want to talk about what an asshole Cuomo is? Everybody else is. We might as well.
Yeah. So I was actually somewhat surprised that he resigned earlier this week, because he is not one to do that. And he's been so stubborn and has been defiant during this whole time, even as more women have come out. So he had this cluster of a press conference where he took no responsibility, attempted to justify his behavior as just being a man who's not with the new times, apparently, because apparently it's something new as of 2021 that, you know, you can't harass or prey on women or grope them without consent.
I've looked through my inbox, Brandon. I don't see any emails from the government that says, hey, you can't do this anymore. So,
right. It's interesting. So he and his attorneys and those around him have done everything that they could to discredit his accusers too, and really just attack them personally. And that was on the display. And it was very sad that I think, and kind of pathetic that the end of his governorship has come down to this, right? That this is going to be his final, what he's remembered by at the very end.
Yeah.
I think he would have better spent his time talking about his political accomplishments rather than trying to justify his behavior and defend his behavior.
I mean, you use the term old school, and I think that's a term that Cuomo sees himself in those terms. And he's so committed to old school. The press conference he gave was right out of 1987. The fact that the 116 page report comes out corroborating these women's stories, and you send your lawyer out there to just tear all of them down and attack them all.
Right.
It's like Cuomo has not seen. He's not seen what's happened the last 10 years, or he just doesn't care, or he's so arrogant he thought it would never happen to him. I heard today that Cuomo started his career in government working for his father at 24. So he's been in a power position in the state of New York his entire life. So I guess it's easy to see how somebody could be in such a bubble that they are just completely unaware of their own behavior and how upsetting and offensive their behavior is. I love it when older guys bust out, I'm just a 63-year-old Italian. What do you expect of me? And I saw this on Twitter, and I, this may be a meme, but did Fox, I think it was, or OAN actually run the Chiron under Cuomo, "I'm not a pervert, I'm just Italian," in quotes? Did he actually say that at some point?
Oh, that's a good, I don't know. I did not see that on the Cryon. So, and I saw most of the press conference, but I had to dip out for part of it. So I don't know if he actually said that or not.
And none of this is generational, and none of this is cultural. This has nothing to do with he's 63, and it has even less to do with that he's Italian. What this has to do with is he's been in a power position his whole life. He exerts power over people. He's done it from a very early age, and this is how the world of work works for Andrew Cuomo, and it's always worked this way.
Yeah.
The only change now is women have enough power in the workplace to say, we're not going to put up with this. That was the change that Cuomo missed. And it's just, I'm just always amazed when the old guy comes out and says, "I'm just an old lech. What do you expect from me?"
Right. Like somehow that's that makes everything OK. It's just,
I mean, how can you expect a man to work with women his whole life and not grab a side boob? Right. I mean, that's literally how he comes out. Like, I just can't believe you people, you know, are so upset by this. And I just, the whole thing was just an idiotic scene.
Yeah. I mean, someone who has been around in politics as long as he has, you would think he would know, you know, the way to handle his going out, his resignation. And instead, he just, I think, engenders more ill will and more disgust. I mean, based on what he did.
Why give 14 days? He didn't need to give a 2 weeks notice. What does he think is going to happen in his last 2 weeks in office?
I don't know. Going back to what you said a moment ago, it looks like that cryon was not his actual quote. So that was Fox News summarizing. Now, his actual quote, what he said, which I remember seeing this in real time now, was as an Italian, I've always kissed and hugged in a casual way, and I've never crossed the line with anyone.
Have you ever worked with someone, male or female, that's just a talk toucher, that they cannot talk to you? I have one time, and I literally had to tell the person, stop touching me.
Right.
I mean, she wasn't, it was nothing offensive. It was just every time she talked to you, she would grab your wrist or she'd grab at your arm.
Or your shoulder.
And after a while, it's like, just you, that is... even if you're 63 in Italian, that's just off-putting to anyone. And it's so easy to see how off-putting it is. I don't know a single woman that I've ever worked with, even if ones that I were very close to, that if I consistently put my hand on their shoulder or back, they wouldn't turn around and say, what are you doing? And stop
it. Well, and you know, it's interesting because he tries to justify this as just kind of like touchy, huggy Italian behavior, but he, you know, sidelines. I mean, the accusations made are, you know, that this was behavior with sexual innuendos and, you know, and that were made and suggestive language. Like, it wasn't just in the context of someone who's huggy, huggy, touchy, touchy with everybody. You know, it was specific to young women who worked for him with innuendos that were attached, you know, the groping allegation. So it's just, it's somebody who's trying to, I think, save his reputation and his legacy, and by completely denying what is obvious at this point. But, you know, that's backfiring. I mean, he's going to be remembered now for not taking responsibility and for going out in a very disgraceful manner.
Well, and after that 116-page report came out, he came out with his own report that was mostly pictures of him and other politicians.
Yes.
Oddly, weirdly touching, kissing. What? This is your defense.
He had a photo of Chris Christie and Barack Obama, you know, embracing after the hurricane.
I mean, who takes a woman they don't know? I'll go one step farther. Who takes a woman they're not married to, or in a very serious relationship, and put two hands on their face in order to kiss them? That's ridiculous. When is some woman just going to knee some dude right in the nuts and just end all of it? Just drop Cuomo right in the middle of a New York State dinner thing. He touches someone in the back, and some chick just turns around and knocks him out with a punch. Is that what it's going to take for men finally to get the thing? I'm always fascinated with that guy, with the guy who has everything to lose and chooses to lose it over this.
Yeah.
I've just never, what's the
over
calculation?
Over and over again, time and time again. Yeah.
Just don't get it. Do you think he's going to run again?
Oh gosh. I can't even imagine that right now.
He's a three-term governor who would have easily won a fourth without this.
Yeah. I mean, his approval ratings had held strong for the longest time with all these allegations coming out, and he had kind of bounced back and he had been defiant. And again, I think the only reason he resigned was because the New York legislature was going to impeach him. It was obvious they were headed in that direction, which they still might do that anyway, because there is no love lost between Cuomo and his own party and many of them are in the legislature.
Now. Yeah.
I guess he could come back and he could try, but I mean, what is he going to run? I guess governor again? Like, what's the, I don't know. I mean, I do see he's one of those that I think has to remain in the spotlight and feels like he's owed, like, this is it. Like, I mean, yeah. His political life is his life. He's been in politics for so long. He's a scion of a legacy political family in New York politics. I don't see that he can just completely leave that. So, yeah, the question is, where does this go? Like, how, you know, does he go into lobbying? What does he do?
Well, one theory was that Cuomo was being prepped for to replace Kamala Harris in 2024, that he would either run on the top of the ticket or he would replace Kamala Harris as VP. That's one.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, remember back when, before Clyburn came out, before South Carolina, I mean, Biden is really struggling. And there was some talk that maybe that Cuomo should jump into the race, and then at the time,
that, yeah,
that he would easily be at the top of everyone's consideration. I don't know. These stories, I was about, they're not sad, because this guy is just, he completely deserves whatever he has coming to him. It's just sad to think, all right, we've been through all of the Me Too stuff, which was greatly needed, but just how far we still have to go.
Yeah, it is sad. I mean, there's still, it shows that it's always kind of like one step forward, you know, several steps backward. I mean, that's how it is in American life.
To any woman out there, if any man touches you at work, just turn right around, look him right in the eye in a very loud voice in front of everyone, and tell him, "You touch me like that again, I'm going to knock your ass out." I guarantee you, he will never look at you, touch you, speak to you again. Never.
Yeah. Well, it always comes down to the power dynamic, right? These are always instances where it's the boss, you know, it's the guy at the top who is leveraging his power and knowingly engaging this behavior, because he knows that he has the ability to do, because he's going to incite fear in those under him, and they're not going to be as willing to challenge him without retribution, without getting fired. But I think there's less fear of that now, right? Because we
has
have
Me
a society.
Too changed any of that?
I think so, because as a society, we are much more likely to stand by and with women who have accusations that turn out to be true, where this behavior is happening. And it's no longer a stigma attached, where in past cases, many of those women may have felt like, well, I'm not going to be able to get the same type of job, or I'm going to be blacklisted, or I'm going to my ability to advance is going to be inhibited now by what he says to other people if I don't reciprocate. So I think that's less of an issue than it used to be, much less so.
I just, for any man who ever puts a woman in that position, you're just a scumbag. That nobody deserves to be put in that spot over somebody with the perceived, well, not with the perceived, with the actual power,
the actual
to control
power.
Their career. That's not good. Hey, people are still getting sick from COVID too. Talking about another awesome topic.
Some things have changed. Yeah. So we have the Delta variant, and we have Delta Plus, and we have Lambda, which is, you know, so the variants are going. We have 50% of the country that still isn't vaccinated. So we have this petri dish, this the host for these variants to spread and to multiply.
Yeah.
Until we get to at least between 60 and 70% of the population vaccinated. And we have some states that are just, I think, having critical outbreaks and are even worse than they were at the height of last year's pandemic, partially because, if you recall last year, we had the mitigation measures in place. Many of these states that are seeing the most severe outbreaks don't. They no longer are masking. There's no distancing. There's no limitations on behavior. And so you have cases like what you have in Arkansas, where there, as of this past beginning of this past week, they only had 8 ICU beds available in the entire state, which I think people forget that outside of the mortality rate, the big issue is the hospitalization rate. Because if you have hospitals that fill up with COVID patients, if you need to go to an emergency room and stay overnight for anything other than COVID, you may not have a bed available. I mean, you may be at a disadvantage. Yeah. And that's what's scary. And that's why there's all this emphasis on trying to keep hospitalizations down and triage. And you, what you have in many states is you have people that are being floated between hospitals to try to balance out the load on hospital staff and on capacity. And Texas and Florida are also, you know, just, I think, in dire straits. And both of those states have governors who have gone the other extreme, where they have signed executive actions barring businesses from requiring masks, barring cities and municipalities from enacting their own mask mandates, and schools barring them from requiring masks, which is interesting because DeSantis is an example. His own kids go to a private school, which has a mask mandate.
DeSantis. I don't, I don't know what DeSantis and Abbott in Texas are doing. I know what DeSantis is doing. He's laying the groundwork to run for president.
Yeah.
He is trying to thread this needle that he is Donald Trump's policies without Donald Trump's Twitter account. And that's a very hard thing to do because the people, if you're, because he's doing this thing where he knows, without knowing if Trump's running or not, he's got to play to that MAGA base. He knows he's going nowhere without them. So he's trying to thread this needle to where, yes, he keeps those people kind of on and energized and in his corner. And he's taken a lesson from Trump. In order to keep the MAGA people with you, you can ask nothing of them. That's the number one thing. You never ask them to sacrifice. You never ask them to give. You never ask them to change a position. You are there. You are here for them. It's like the line in the French Revolution. Show me which way the crowd's marching so that I can go lead them. Part of what DeSantis knows, if he ever comes out and challenges that group or asks that group to do something or points a finger at that group, they're gone. Can you think of any time Trump tried to hold the MAGA crowd accountable for anything? That's not what they're there for.
No, that's not. I mean, and Trump buckled each and every time. I mean, he buckled when it came to the e-cigarette issue with the vape smoking. He's buckled. He buckled when it came to his own mandates and what was initially proposed in his administration due to pushback from his base. I mean, he has time and time again. That the whole reason that Trump and Melania were vaccinated privately and they did not tell anybody was because he didn't want to anger his anti-vax base. So this is something that's played out time and time again, but I don't think it's not a needle that can be threaded. And I think DeSantis will see that. His approval rating was 56% back in early July, average across polls. Outfit called St. Pete's Polls, which is a local polling firm in Florida, has pinpointed that he's at like 44-45%. He's underwater now. He is behind by 1 to 2 points in all the head-to-head matchups against his likely and probable opponents next year. So this is having a political impact for him, and the tide is turning. And so he can keep his MAGA base and somehow try to retain their good graces. But in doing so, he's going to lose so much of the rest of the public, and the MAGA base is not enough to win. And the MAGA base too, again, you have to be 100% with them. I mean, they had gone to be already with being skeptical of him because he was promoting vaccination at one point. And so, they started abandoning him. And so there's a real question of, even if he has 100% of the MAGA base locked up, because, he might not have that.
The movie The Hunt for Red October, there's a scene in it where Alec Baldwin like disrupts this meeting, this like cabinet level meeting in the Navy. And with this idea that the sub is actually, he's actually defecting. He's not here to make war. He's defecting. It's a scene where that first theory is kind of thrown out. And after the meeting clears out, he meets with a senator, the only politician in the room. And the politician gives Alec Baldwin a line that goes something like, I'm a politician. What that means is I'll lie to your face in the morning and I'll kiss your baby and steal his candy at night. But it also means I always keep my options open. That's the number one rule of being a politician. You always give yourself the leeway to wiggle off the hook if it is required. DeSantis has backed himself into some weird political corner that I don't know if he's left himself a path out of. I mean, performative law is DeSantis' specialty. The idea that he's going to ban cruise lines from demanding vaccine, that law has already been shot down.
A judge has already shot that down, and that's insane to me. I mean, he was willing to cripple Florida's tourism industry, which is dependent upon cruise ships, you know, to score points with the MAGA base, which, again, insanity, let alone not only was he willing to hurt Florida's tourism industry, but an entire industry itself. And the cruise ships are like, you can't do this. I mean, we need to be able to mandate vaccination or nobody is going to feel safe traveling on a cruise ship.
The social media law he enacted, which is even too stupid to try to even outline, that one is, I think that already got challenged and is gone. I mean,
the other thing that hasn't passed yet, the one where he was going to force academics to take this survey about their political allegiances and, you know, were result in lost funding. That was another ridiculous thing as too.
So I think DeSantis has said it is not, we have not outlawed masks. All we've said is that the school board cannot mandate them. So DeSantis is his talk track is, hey, if a parent wants to send their kid to school with a mask, this law I signed doesn't prevent that. All it basically says is at the local level, the school board can't make a mask mandate. But he's letting his intent be known.
Right. I mean, and again, the fact of the matter is like nobody, it would be crazy to ban parents from, you know, on their own masking their kids for safety reasons. But this is another example of where Republicans have abandoned a core tenet. Republicans have always stood for local control, that it's best to let local school districts, local entities, cities, counties make decisions that impact their communities. And with regard to the pandemic, these governors have said, no, we're not going to allow these local entities to make their own policies. That's going to be top down, and they are not allowed to have these types of restrictions. And when it comes to masking, I think in particular, it's an example of again trying to play to a base and play to a base that just doesn't believe in the science behind the virus and doesn't take it as seriously as to others. That's what it comes down to.
I get the, hey, you can't put in a mask mandate law. I understand politically what he's trying to do. Brandon, what possibly could be the political advantage in threatening to withhold payment of local school board members that allow masks? That's the part where it's like, okay, now I've lost the thread. What are you trying to accomplish here?
Well, I mean, it's a form of coercion, right? So you're basically threatening them that if they go against you, and that if masks are required, you're going to retaliate. And so it's a way to ensure that there is no, deviation from this policy that you've set out, that
is that
kids
him,
will not be masked.
Is that him kind of proving he's the tough man Trump was?
Yeah, I think so. It's one of those things that gets plaudits from the base. It's one of those things that he can use in a fundraising email, and I'm sure he already has, and send it out and said, I stood up to the liberal bureaucrats and I threatened to withhold their pay for, you know, making your kids wear masks, and that's, I'm not going to stand for you and for your rights. I mean, I can write the email if I wanted to, and I don't want to, but I can see it now. Like,
yeah, see it now.
I think that's what it is, right? I mean, it's more performative politics. Yeah. It's setting this up for use in fundraising, for scoring political points with the base. You have to remember, too, DeSantis was in this race for a while with some other Trumpian people to see who was going to be the heir apparent.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that went back and forth between Kristi Noem in South Dakota, who for a while was the darling. And then she lost some of them by – Kristi Noem actually has deferred to local control when it has come to mask mandates, even though there's been no state requirements. She hasn't barred localities from doing their own thing. That's caused the ire of the MAGA base to rise up against her. So she's no longer in vogue, but DeSantis is, and he sees an opening. And so he is going heavy on this and is unwilling to give it up because it's the one area where he can differentiate himself from everybody else.
And that's interesting that the CPAC poll that came out last month or in July, Kristi Noem, Tom Cotton, Josh Hawley, they had zero support. Yeah. There was no appetite for any of those folks. DeSantis and Trump were the only two that really showed any plausible path to the nomination. It's early, but that's what that data point said. I believe that the Democrats have a huge Biden problem in that there is no bench behind Biden.
Yeah.
If DeSantis flames out, let's say next year DeSantis doesn't win the governorship of Florida, who are the Republicans going to turn to? Is it Trump? I mean, the Republicans' problem is, I mean, okay, you could see a scenario where DeSantis could be where DeSantis could appeal to Americans in mass enough to win the presidency. You could also see another couple decisions out of him, and he's lost that. I guess what I'm trying to think through is if DeSantis flames out somehow through this, if COVID clips him in some way, and he doesn't get to run in the way that he wants to run, are we just saying it's Trump by default?
I think so. I think if he doesn't win the governorship, he's out. Like, I mean, that's the end for DeSantis. I don't see how he has a platform to run on if he can't win re-election in his own state. But assuming he does win re-election, he's likely the favorite. But without him, it starts to fall apart. That's where it gets really murky, because I think that's where you start to see what we've typically seen Democrats experience, where you have this protracted, primary cycle. And there's going to be several people fighting out on the margins of votes, very close, to see who's going to be the heir apparent. And I don't. And again, there's so much up in the air with Trump. What does he run? Does he not? But just taking that aside for a moment, assuming he doesn't run again, who is it to say that you don't have somebody like Tucker Carlson decide to throw his hat into the race? I mean, we've seen performance politics do well, and you know, would it surprise me to see some unconventional candidates?
Can you picture the first debate for the 2022 Republican primary, and Donald Trump is on stage with Kristi Noem, Rick Scott, Tom Cotton, Josh? He'd eat those people alive.
Oh, yeah.
It would, there's no way.
And they would be falling over each other to show deference to him and say, well, I've been most aligned and I've
kissed his ass during the debate.
And then he, at the same time, would be attacking them in personal terms and poking fun at them and mocking them. It would be that would be tough to watch.
Did you see what he put out today about Ashley Babbitt?
I did, on his blog.
Good God. We don't have time to get into the Mike Lindell lunacy. Have you checked out the Cyber Symposium?
I saw that it happened, but there was no big reveal. So where is that? You know,
I will admit that on Tuesday, I logged on and listened to it for about 25 minutes. It's the most batshit crazy. He had people on from Colorado who were allegedly testifying about fraud. It was insane. I can't believe that is still going on, and that there's a group of people that still believe at some
still
point
believe it,
goods
yes.
are going to be delivered.
And that Donald Trump will be restored to the presidency. The Supreme Court is going to overturn an election, which they constitutionally cannot do.
No, this is going to happen because Biden will be so embarrassed by the evidence that he didn't lose. Brandon, he's going to give the presidency to Trump. That's how
it's going
to
be that easy. Okay.
That easy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, And this is also in the context of this. It's been, what, 4 months now since this quote-unquote audit, the sham audit in Arizona has been going on. Another example of something that's just...
Charlie Sykes on his podcast had the guy on who's basically
the recorder, Maricopa County.
And he's just like, there's nothing you can do. He's the one that sent them the letter. Just get this over with, put out what you're ever going to put out, but be prepared to go to court when you do, because that's where this is headed.
Well, and I didn't know when he said, and it makes sense that they're going to have to purchase all these new voting machines, because now that they've been in the hands of this cyber ninja firm, you know, they're compromised, and so they can't, you know, use them. And so that's another expense added on to this, ironically.
Just ridiculous. Let's end with.
I did want to mention another thing that happened this week. For those that don't know, Tucker Carlson was over in Hungary doing this tour with Viktor Orban, who's the autocratic president of Hungary, and just talking about how great Hungary is. And even though he's a proud American, he is just amazed by the level of freedom that exists in Hungary. This is so ridiculous and so problematic on a number of places. But first and foremost, for those that don't know, Hungary has been trending autocratic for the past several years, right under Viktor Orban. They do not have freedom of speech. The media is tightly controlled by the government. All of the institutions have been politicized. Career civil servants have been forced out. Ethnic minorities as well as LGBT persons are persecuted. Like, Hungary has really moved into an anti-democratic mindset under Viktor Orban. And it's interesting that you would have Tucker Carlson go over there and say, this is someone we should emulate, when freedom doesn't exist. And by the way, somebody like Tucker Carlson, who is outspoken against the federal government here on TV every single night, that cannot exist in Hungary. That's not allowed. I mean, you would not have a broadcaster like Tucker Carlson over there because he would be denied a permit to even operate on cable television.
Tucker Carlson is trying to normalize authoritarianism.
Yes, that's exactly what he's attempting to do.
There's no other way to look at it. The only question is why? What's in it? I think we both agree that the main things that drive Tucker Carlson is being on TV and making money.
Yeah.
So is that what this is? Is there something more? If this is just Tucker doing this to be a troll, hey, congrats, Tucker. You've accomplished everything you wanted to accomplish with this. Is that all this is?
I mean, it could be. And again, like you said, I think Tucker's most concerned about his, just his ability to make money going forward. And, you know, that he continues to be a leading voice on the right, and that he is the voice of the right. So to do that, he has to evolve into where the right is going. So there's some question, you know, is he leading the right to authoritarianism, or is he just reflecting the trend lines of where the right is going in America under Trump? And so he may just be a reflection of that. And so he, you know, I think is moving in that direction partially because he sees that's where the power is, that's where the money is, that's where the leadership is, and the influence. And if he wants to continue to have the influence he has, he needs to move in that direction. But again, even if there's no ramifications directly, he is resetting the norms. And that's what's scary, is he is normalizing a country that most of his audience has no idea where it is or the history or context or anything. But they're going to look at Hungary now as somehow this amazing bastion of freedom that America needs to emulate without knowing anything that's taking place.
What I found most weird about his week-long stay over there is how he kept coming back to how he was so impressed of how they took control of Hungary's culture, the government, and how they really helped define kind of this return to traditional culture. It's like, Tucker, if you're trying to talk in code, you're doing a very poor job of it. I mean, that was – it's obvious – Tucker is trying to whip people up, get them excited about the culture war, and that the country is being taken over and stolen. This fits into his narrative on immigration. And I guess maybe what he's trying to do is to tie together that if we keep allowing these, what I'm going to call non-traditional cultural influences in the United States, eventually to take back the right culture, you can't see me, I'm air quoting this, we're going to have to be more authoritarian in our approach to do so. Okay, I don't know of anybody calling for that, but if you want to try to create a movement to say we should be more like Hungary and clamp down culturally, I don't see any avenue for that to move forward, but all right.
And again, in Hungary, Viktor Orban, so culturally, he has scapegoated immigrants for Hungary's problems.
Sure.
Blamed George Soros. He's blamed the LGBT community. He has, you know, used them as scapegoats, which is what autocrats do, to detract and to deflect from the problems with government and their own corruption, right? And corruption is rampant in the Hungarian government, but that's not something that they want people to know. So it's like, look over here, look at these immigrants that are causing problems. Even though Hungary does not allow any immigrants and is, you know, barely has any. The interesting thing is, so they're doing all this from a culture perspective, but if you look at Hungary itself, it's very different than the U.S.
It's like 12 million people in Hungary.
Right, 12 million people, very kind of monolithic, homogenous culture. There's barely any immigration at all. But at the same time, like, you know, this focus on culture and tradition and children and the family, like most Hungarians are not having kids. Their population is receding quite a bit. They've lost influence in Europe. Hungary has become closer to China. And even during the Trump era, Hungary was not really a solid ally of the United States to the degree that like Poland was and some of the other Eastern European countries like Lithuania and Latvia. So Hungary is an interesting country for somebody like Tucker to say we should emulate, when if you really look at their history and where they are now, they're not like us in many aspects at all.
How about we make this deal? On the left, we'll stop comparing the Nordic countries and their form of socialism as something that we could do in the United States if the Republicans stop saying Hungary is the type of authoritarianism we want in the United States.
Right.
Because I think comparisons aren't accurate. I want to talk about
because this. Both the Scandinavian countries and Hungary too, again, are homogenous populations, right? They're small populations. Hungary is about the
stable population.
Right. Hungary is about the size of Michigan. You know, it's small. And then the Scandinavian countries have populations that are, you know, really like, I think like less than a third of the state of California alone. So you're talking about homogenous, stable populations, small. You're talking about policies that just wouldn't work for a country our size, which gets lost in the debate.
So Brandon, my wife made me, I'm going to blame my wife for this. My wife made me watch this show on Netflix called Outer Banks. Have you watched this show?
I have not. Is it a new series, Netflix series?
There's two seasons of it. This
I've
is
heard
the
of it.
Most
I've heard the name. I didn't know what it was about.
Insane show I've ever seen. Because what they did when they sat down to write this show, they basically said character development has nothing to do with this show. A consistent plot has nothing to do with this show.
Oh, okay.
The pace and the tempo. Usually, you know, there's a story arc. There's a conflict. There's a conclusion. Let's just throw all of that out and let's just have a show that we try to pack as much action into 60 minutes as we can. So, Brandon, you'll like this show. It's a bunch of kids. I believe it's North Carolina high school kids. Oh, by the way, the actors that play them are all in their mid to upper 20s, of course. But it's a bunch of high school kids that, I mean, they're after this treasure of gold from a slave ship. And I can't even begin to get into the plot, that there's so many plot lines to it. All I'll leave you with is this. All major characters in this show die, come back to life. That's a big one of theirs. And you have six stories going at once that sometimes intertwine and sometimes just die out.
That sounds like super confusing and headache inducing. So all these kids that died, so do they all share like a unique bond, or are they all tied together somehow? Is that why
They all have like terrible family home lives. They're never home. They rarely go to school. And this was the real bitch of season one. This is where season one really confused me. None of them had cell phones. It's like the writers completely missed that if this was supposed to be in 2021, that nobody had a cell phone season one, allegedly because a storm knocked it out. It knocked it out for like 6 months. It's the most bizarre show I've ever seen. I can't say that I like it, because most of the times I watch it and just look over my wife and be like, you've got to be kidding me.
So your wife is a fan? Is she really into it? Is it?
She likes it just because it's Jody likes completely turn your mind off entertainment. And there is no more turn your mind off than this. It's just silly, good looking people running around in warm weather on boats. That's another thing. There's always like a $1 million boat you could steal or somebody has. And they take a boat from the Carolinas to the Bahamas, and they just know how to get there. It's the stupidest thing you've ever seen, but I'm totally invested in this show. Whoever the Outer Banks are, I don't know who you wrote that show for, but my wife and I completely hooked on Outer Banks.
Interesting. So a couple things I've watched recently. I saw the film Stillwater last weekend.
Is that any good?
With Matt Damon. I was not, I don't know. I didn't really like it. I was kind of indifferent. Okay. I without giving away any spoilers, it's a very long movie. It drags a bit at times. It's just, it doesn't resolve, I think, like most audience members might expect it to going in. Again, without trying to give anything away, it's very melancholy. It has this very kind of indie feel. The plot line is very different. People have said it's like loosely based on the Amanda Knox case, the Seattle girl who was
Stone Brothers. She has said that.
Well, and that's what's, I think, crazy, right? Because she has said that when really it isn't. The only commonality is that they've taken an American college student who's female, who is implicated in a murder. This one's in France. Amanda Knox was in Italy. And then that's it. Like from that point on, everything else around the story and what happened is different. The way that this turns out is very different. The background of the main character and her family, very different than Amanda Knox. So I don't know why Amanda Knox came out and said that, because first of all, I wouldn't want the plot line here is very different. So I wouldn't want to be associated with it. And it's just, it's not, it's again, that's the only commonality is in a murder in Europe. The
plot that you laid out is Amanda Knox, a student in Europe, gets involved in a murder case.
Well, yeah, I guess true. Yeah. But everything else is different from that point on in terms of how the trial proceeds, like the family dynamic. There's so much else at play. The victim. I mean, there's a lot. Everything else they kept very different. So it's just it has some common points, but I don't know. It was an interesting role for Matt Damon. In some aspects, he was kind of unrecognizable. You know, he's playing this Oklahoma oil rig worker, the father of the girl who's accused. I don't know. It was just I thought it was disappointing. I was not. It was just one of those that I kind of left. I was like, well, that's that's about all I can say.
That should just be better than what it was.
Yeah, it should be. It was one of those films that there was a lot of hype about it, and it'll probably be up for a lot of awards and maybe for an Oscar, but it didn't live up to the hype, I thought.
When's this glut of good movies come out? I keep waiting for when is the glut of like backlogged of good movies hit theaters? Because it doesn't look like there's much new out, and it doesn't look like there's a lot of quality out either.
No, there haven't been. So I'm waiting on that as well. I'd like to see some more quality films out. And I've gone to see a lot of movies this summer, but they've been just subpar films, I feel like, for the most part.
Did you watch Ted Lasso?
I did. So I've been watching that as the second season with every new episode on Friday.
Okay. So is it just me, or season one was fantastic? Season two sucks.
Yeah, I'm not, I wouldn't go that far. I still like it. And maybe it's because I've really kind of bonded with the characters and I like all the characters, but the plot lines are definitely not as good. The plot devices are off and it's just, it doesn't have the same kind of like, I think feel good kind of mentality that the first season had. It's lacking like that. It's
just out the writing team.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, it season seems to have lost its mojo. It kind of just flounders along now, and I don't know where it's going to go. Apparently, the next episode that's coming out this Friday is a Christmas episode, so that's...
Yeah, I hate those. Yeah. Christmas episodes, Halloween episodes. Back when you had network TV and only 12 TV shows on, that was a big thing, and they always sucked. You always knew a TV show on network TV was about to go off the air when they had the musical episode. That was that was the telltale sign of, well, you're about to get canceled.
And I'm kind of the same way, because most of the time they all blend together, like those holiday episodes of series. The only series, and again, as a 90s kid that I grew up on, where I liked the holiday episode was Friends, because the Thanksgiving episode was always like super hilarious. And it was like the laughs and the jokes were magnified for that episode every season. But otherwise, I was not crazy. I mean, I couldn't recall a single holiday episode outside of that.
Yeah. I remember watching like in the 80s, the Moonlighting Holiday Christmas special. It's like, this show sucks. This TV back then wasn't that good.
It wasn't a
Christmas episode. I'm going to save you.
The other thing that I've been watching, there's a second season of on Netflix, is The Movies That Made Us, which is just this like docu-style. Each one's like 40, 45 minutes on the classic movies we've come to know and love from like the 70s, 80s, 90s, like how they happened, because most of these films like almost never got green-lighted. They were never optioned. It was just like by happenstance or chance. They were rejected numerous times. There was crazy stuff that happened where they almost stopped filming many of these. So I've that has been really compelling. I watched all of last season, so I'm watching this season. It starts with Back to the Future as one of the key films, Pretty Woman, Jurassic Park, Forrest Gump.
I watched that series when it was The Toys That Made Us, and it was really good. So I can imagine that's pretty good.
Yeah, I do recommend it, it is good. I've learned a lot from this, and I learned just how much does it go according to plan when these films were made. Like, I mean, these films almost fell apart in many cases. Yeah. And then now we can't imagine like not having these iconic films and who stars in them. And so I'm
looking forward to more iconic films eventually coming out at some point.
No, and maybe that's partially why I like this, because we haven't seen any new great films, and so I'm like hearkening back to the films of old.
Yeah, that's true. All right, Brandon, that's our hour. Thanks,
Greg.
Thanks for listening to 2 Men in the Middle. Make sure to give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Check out our website at 2meninthemiddle.com. Drop us an email at 2meninthemiddle@gmail.com or tweet at us at 2meninthemiddle. We'll see you next week.